This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If epidemiological modeling is new to the political press, it's also new to the rest of us, even though we are all enlisted in the effort to, quote, flatten the curve. But Josh Epstein, director of New York University's agent-based modeling lab, is an old hand. And he says the partisan attacks on the projections misunderstand what they're for.
I think it's reckless, anti-scientific blather, honestly.
Why is it so wrong?
Well, first of all, I don't know which models they have in mind. I mean, most of the models that I'm familiar with have made conservative estimates of the likely fatality rates and cases. Here's what happens if you do nothing. And then there are projections of what happens if you undertake social distancing.
There is a model that is being cited often by the White House.
The University of Washington model that the White House is citing today is done by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation.
The University of Washington that modeled from cases up, utilizing the experience around the globe.
In the United States, they had been projecting 81,766 deaths, and now they're projecting 60,415.
Tell me about that model and how it's made and how it's working.
Models generally produce forecasts, but they can arrive at them in very different ways. The kind we build at my lab represents individual people moving around on maps. They bump into each other. They sneeze on each other. They give the guy the bug. He gets over it after some time, and so forth. And there's a detailed history for every little software person in the model. All these details and an actual transmission dynamic is represented. That's one kind of model. Another kind is the kind at the Institute for Health Metrics. And they call themselves health metrics, not health modeling, a sensible name, because they don't do modeling of the kind I just described. They take statistical data and extrapolate forward as it comes in. As more data comes in, they change the extrapolation, just like weather forecasts change their extrapolations as data comes in.
But you think that maybe it's had too much attention because it hasn't predicted behavior. And so it was bound to be off because behavior is vital in considering these things.
If they had a model that had anticipated that distancing was going to happen, then they'd have anticipated the initial curve would bend over as distancing took place. So they wouldn't be in this position of having a first exponential estimate without distancing, and a second one with it. They'd incorporate distancing and behavior into their model, as other people do.
One of the most prominent models is the one that comes from the Imperial College of London.
In the UK, a big increase in restrictions on everyday life has been partly prompted by research from Imperial College London. The scientific modeling from a team there warned that Britain was on course for a catastrophic epidemic.
They warn in a new study that without dramatic action, the novel coronavirus could kill as many as 2.2 million people living in the United States.
What did you think of that model?
It's really a very, very well done study with quite credible conclusions about what would happen in a completely do-nothing scenario. Now, you know, you don't ever get to test that one because it was so scary that people did something. And I think that's constructive. So look, I mean, they're operating under a lot of uncertainty too. They published the model before all the data is known. I'm sure they've revised their model as well.
So what do you think of this bit of advice that Dr. Fauci offered late last month on Jake Tapper's CNN show? It was a warning about projected worst-case scenarios regarding deaths.
I've never seen a model of the diseases that I've dealt with, which the worst case scenario actually came out. They always overshoot. So when you use numbers like a million and a half, 2 million, that almost certainly is off the chart. Now, it's not impossible, but very, very unlikely. Looking at what we're seeing now, you know, I would say between 100 and 200,000 deaths. I mean, we're going to have millions of cases, but I just don't think that we really need to make a projection when it's such a moving target that you could so easily be wrong and mislead people.
Nobody would say, I predict absolutely. They're saying, look, here are reasonable assumptions subject to the data in hand. On those assumptions, this is a range of outcomes that's plausible, and the upper end of that range are these numbers. It's not like I predict that and I overshot. It's I feel a responsibility to give you the range and to be conservative analysts because we need to prepare for the worst one. It's like hope for the best, prepare for the worst.
I'm reminded of the people who made fun of the Y2K hysteria after the fact. They failed to realize that those warnings did spur people to make changes. Therefore, the disaster was averted.
Think about modeling the way Churchill thought about democracy, right? It's the worst of all possible worlds, except for the alternatives. You have no other way to think in an orderly manner without models.
There was a quote often attributed to a British statistician named George Box. All models are wrong, but some are useful.
Yeah, that's a very nice quote that all modelers are fond of. What Box is saying is all models are idealizations. All models have to simplify. Borges once had an anecdote about a map of the United States that's the same size as the United States. It's not useful to have a map that's a complete replica of the thing it's mapping. It's only useful if it simplifies. And models are caricatures and simplifications and idealizations. Picasso said, art is a lie that helps us see the truth. And I think that's the case in all the best models. Of course, they're not right in some engineering high-fidelity sense, but they capture what's essential to the dynamics with as few moving parts as possible so that the core drivers of events are visible and are testable against data. So I think that's what Box is saying. It's not a dismissive point at all.
Right. Is there anything that the public can do to assess the reliability of a model that they're looking at?
You know, I think what modelers have to do is be as transparent as possible about how it really works and try to provide an understandable narrative of events as the model rolls ahead, as it iterates through the possible futures day by day. It should explicitly identify the known data that it's using. I mean, if we're having a new estimate of the reproductive number, the R-naught, the incubation period, the case fatality rate, I mean, be explicit about how you're using those in your model and what difference they make to the forecast. You know, this is like weather forecasting. You'll update your forecast as data comes in and just be explicit about your uncertainties.
And then you can take your Sharpie and include Alabama?
That's why you use models. So you're not making Sharpie estimates off the top of your head.
You mentioned R-naught and a number of other terms. So let's talk about the lexicon we have recently acquired. Start with the flatten the curve graph. Let's picture them. There are two lines, one with a high peak where we do nothing, one that's lower and wider as a result of social distancing. You've said that they're simplifications. That means they're not really so smooth, right?
Yeah, I mean, in the real world, there's a lot of noise. They jiggle around, and they don't have this, you know, perfect, smooth shape that those diagrams show. But they're qualitatively right. They all rise to a peak and then descend after the peak. And typically, in real epidemics and in those curves, half the transmission happens after the peak. I think a lot of people are really misunderstanding what it means to be at the peak of an epidemic. You hear a lot of talk about we're at the peak, and so you can breathe a sigh of relief, and we're out of the woods. Typically, the peak of an epidemic is the midpoint of the epidemic. You're not out of the woods. You're in the very heart of the woods, and roughly half the cases are in front of you. So anybody who thinks we should just reopen the economy because we've made it to the peak is reckless error. If you can flatten the curve, the peak isn't as high, so it doesn't exceed the hospital capacity. So it's not that you're getting fewer cases, they're just coming at you at a different pace. Deaths would probably be lower because you have more capacity to ward off these fatalities.
Even if we do nothing, infection curves have a peak. They just don't keep going up and up and up and up until we're all exterminated. Do they?
No, they don't, because people are recovering from the disease as the infection grows. But I mean, this brings us to this question of R naught, all right? Mm-hmm. The R naught value is calculated this way. It's if I take a bowl of susceptible, perfectly healthy people and I drop one infected person into that bowl, how many susceptible people will directly get the infection from that infected person? The R naught is just this one initial number that's very useful in estimating the early exponential phase of an epidemic. But it doesn't stay exponential. It reaches a peak and then comes down. Mm-hmm. And R naught is just the first of these numbers. But all these so-called reproductive rates fall in the course of the epidemic as you run out of susceptibles. A lot of people use R naught as if it were a kind of doubling rate like rabbits multiplying. But that can't happen. If I have 10 rabbits, the first one gives it to 2, they give it to 2, so there's 4, they give it to 2, so there's 8, they give it to 2, so there's 16. No, you can't have 16 because I ran out of rabbits at 10. The thing can't keep going at R naught indefinitely because you run out of
susceptible rabbits.
Exactly right. The reproductive numbers always fall in the course of the epidemic because it's harder for an infective to find the next susceptible. People are recovering, so the thing bends over. That's why there's a peak.
You wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago about a different kind of model, how fear spreads. Strikes me fear is a perfectly reasonable reaction. Why would you track it, and how did you track it in your behavioral models?
Well, it's double-edged. On the one hand, the disease generates fear, and the fear generates behavioral change. You get out of circulation because you're afraid of catching the disease. Mm-hmm. That's a good thing because it depresses the epidemic. However, fear also evaporates when the stimulus disappears. So Everybody went to the basement, that depressed the epidemic. Now people look around and say, hey, we're almost out of the woods. Let's go back to normal social life. And the trouble is, if there's still infections circulating, you're pouring susceptibles back on to these embers, and you can reignite a wave of epidemic. So fear is your friend when it's taking you out of circulation, but the extinction of fear is your enemy if it pours you out into the world again too early.
And you say there are four horsemen of COVID-19 fear. Fear about the virus, fear about the economy, probably at some point fear about whatever the new vaccine happens to be.
Well, you know, these measures of putting people back to work in a careful way, putting immunes back to work in a careful way, without bringing on a second wave. These are all techniques to bridge the country until we have an effective vaccine. The problem is that we have tremendous levels of vaccine refusal worldwide and in the United States. The WHO last year declared vaccine refusal to be one of the top 10 threats to global health. And you're seeing the resurgence of measles in Europe and in the United States. And in swine flu in 2009, the WHO declared swine flu to be a global pandemic, and half of Americans refused the vaccine. So when we bring on a vaccine to COVID-19, it's another one of these behavioral factors that is going to loom very large in our capacity to keep this thing at bay.
So how do we control the fear curve?
Okay, one of the big drivers of fear is surprise. One of the ways you control fear is not set rosy expectations that are then thwarted by the reality. President Trump did exactly that by dismissing the threat for many, many weeks. And then when the reality hits home, people are much more shocked, they're much more frightened, and it sends markets into the very panic he's obsessed with. One way to do it is tell the truth as best we know it. Don't paint a rosy picture that sets everyone up for the fear spike when it proves false.
Thanks a lot, Josh.
You're welcome, Brooke.
Joshua M. Epstein is a professor of epidemiology at NYU's School of Global Public Health and director of the NYU Agent-Based Modeling Lab. So, I've been thinking about Shakespeare and time, because we have a rich discussion about Shakespeare that we had to hold till next week for lack of time. Yeah, with time moving so slowly these days, we still manage to run out of it. We'll talk about that too, the experience of time during lockdown, in a future show, in our continuing effort to syncopate that drumbeat of news about the nation's physical, political, and spiritual woes with stories that provoke in more satisfying ways. But back to time. During Shakespeare's time in London, plagues were severe enough to close the theaters in 1582, 1592, 1603, and 1607. Add in the perils of war and childbirth and accident, and for most people, death was never so private or tidy as it's been for the last few generations. My kids are grown, and since they were old enough to remember, they've seen a lot firsthand. Chaotic protests followed by tanks on the streets of Moscow in 1993. Great plumes of smoke after the collapse of the Twin Towers in 2001. A bruising financial crash just as they were making their way into the world in 2008. And now this. And yet, recently one of them asked, "This is the first crisis that I've ever faced as an adult, but is this normal? Does every generation go through something like this?" Interesting, the distinction she draws between global mayhem viewed through the lens of childhood and youth and this one experienced as an entirely independent adult. Actually, that should give parents some comfort. But how do you answer? Every generation thinks they've faced a crisis, but not all crises are created equal. I mean, some of us have managed to slide through life pretty well, still do. I'm talking about the lucky 34% of U.S. workers, give or take, with jobs that we can actually do at home. All we have to do is remember a couple of things, which Randy Newman wrote as a PSA for Los Angeles Public Radio, KPCC.
Stay away from me. Yeah, but keep your distance, please. Stay away from me. Words of love in times like these. I'm gonna be with you 24 hours a day. A lot of people couldn't stand that, but you can. You'll be with me 24 hours a day. What a lucky man I am.
By the song. Proceeds from it will benefit the Ellis Marsalis Center in New Orleans.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Zandra Ellen. We had more help from Anthony Vancey and Eloise Blondio, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.